Serving 10, must win by 2 points.
It is absolute pandemonium here.
I will be the greatest player to ever play the game.
Anybody who won't dive for it
shouldn't be playing.
Get that ball. Get the ball.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Racquetball Show. In this episode, we have our current events segment where we talk about the Tournament of Champions that just happened in Portland, Oregon. We have our instructional segment where we talk about how to dominate center court. There's an interview with Jim Winterton and Thomas Carter. And then we have a mailbag segment. Hope you enjoy. All right, so this will be our current event segment of episode 4. And I want to get into three things in relation to, we're coming off the heels of the Tournament of Champions in Portland. And there are three things I want to discuss related to that. The one is the Live Like John Foundation, which we discussed in episode 3 with Wendell Pelham. I want to get a little bit more into that. I want to do a recap of the tournament as thing number 2. And then third thing I want to give takeaways that I found from this tournament in order to help improve your play, because there are things that I'm going to be implementing to try to improve my own game. So as far as the Live Like John Foundation, and if you haven't already, go back and listen to episode 3 with Wendell Pelham. So he shares the story of his son, John Pelham, who is the namesake of the Live Like John Foundation. And John Wendell's son was killed in combat as a U.S. Army soldier. And his last Facebook post before being killed in combat was, "I can't wait to play racquetball again." So it's a really powerful story. John was an awesome guy. Wendell shares a lot of powerful information. And the Live Like John Foundation is doing just awesome things for racquetball as a sport and for veterans. So check that out and visit the Live Like John Foundation and consider donating to them if you are interested in that. That would be awesome. But at that tournament, Wendell shares a lot about that foundation and a lot of great things happened for that. So I love that part of the Tournament of Champions, and I think that's a big part for everyone at the tournament. And it's awesome. I wanted to get into that a little bit. So thing number 2, the recap of the tournament. So it was an interesting tournament, mainly because Kane Wasilenchuk, Kane was out. He had, I think, some sort of back injury and wasn't able to make it, unfortunately, which, of course, it's a little bit disappointing, you know, to not have the best player of all time at your tournament. I think everyone loves watching him play, but it opens up the draw for everyone else when Kane isn't present at the tournament, because he's so dominant, and you can almost expect, barring injury, that Kane will win any given tournament that he's in, and probably in dominating fashion, probably not even losing a game. So having him out of the tournament made it so that it was open to everyone else, and while I would say Rocky would be the favorite with Kane out, Rocky was a little bit hurt, and he ended up losing to my friend and episode 1 guest, Charlie Pratt, who had an amazing tournament. Charlie, I don't even know what he was seeded, maybe 14th in the tournament, and ended up winning the whole thing, which is, I don't know that it's unprecedented, but you really don't see runs from lower seeds like that happening very often. So it was really cool to see Charlie win his first tier 1 pro stop. Charlie played amazing. Unfortunately, I was his first round victim. It was a close match, but Charlie ended up pulling it out. I'm going to get into some things that I think Charlie did really well in my takeaways for improving your play part of this segment. But it was super awesome to, while, you know, I never like losing to anyone, it was awesome to see, if anyone was going to do it, it was awesome to see Charlie pull out that tournament victory. And as far as the tournament vibe overall, it was awesome. I think, and I don't know that this is the case at every tournament, but the way that that tournament is set up, there's one huge viewing area court with a fully glass left wall and glass back wall, and then three glass courts, glass back wall courts near it. So there's just awesome racquetball going on all the time, and big crowds, especially when people weren't working. And there was free beer right on the side, so I think people were especially into it, given that factor. Especially, like, Saturday night was the finals, and people were just getting so amped for Charlie and cheering him on, and I was one of them. It was exciting. So that was one element of it. The crowds were awesome. The play was awesome. The Live Like John Foundation and the kind of swag that we were given at the tournament was really cool. Wendell Pelham and the tournament directors and hosts really put a lot of effort into this tournament, and it really shows. And I'll say another thing is that a lot of the players I talk to who, you know, traveling pros who go to plenty of tournaments, traveling to different cities for each of them, said that this is one of their favorite tournaments, like outside of the US Open, which I think is overwhelmingly going to be most people's favorite tournament, racquetball-wise. This is people's favorite tournament, is the feedback I got from a fair amount of people. And maybe that's a bias because they're at it right at the moment, and because I'm from Portland. But it's my favorite tournament outside the US Open, and a lot of other players' favorite tournaments. So if you're ever considering going to another big tournament, and of course there are amateur events and everything in this tournament as well, which are great, I'd say the Tournament of Champions in Portland is a great choice, and Portland is a cool town. I'm biased, of course, being from the area, but it's an awesome tournament, and I would recommend checking it out. The third thing I wanted to get into is takeaways for improving your play, and I want to, every tournament, of course, when I'm not playing, or when I am playing, and I'm losing, and I'm realizing my deficiencies, and what people are doing that's better than me, I try to take notes and reflect on what people are doing that I could personally improve on, and that in general people could improve on. So I'm looking to share those here. And my takeaways for improving my own play, and this is largely through seeing Charlie beat me whenever I lose. I want to have a reason for why I lost, so that I can improve upon it. And also from just seeing how Charlie was able to sustain the high level of play that he had and carry it through five tough matches. He played, five either close matches or five matches with, like, tough players. So I found that Charlie's conditioning was a big factor in allowing him to do that. I thought that I could tell in my match, and I could tell in just watching in the other matches, he was a step ahead of his opponent at the end of matches. That importance is often understated, because when you're a step ahead of your opponent, there are those extra adjustment steps that you should be making in a given rally, where if you're taking that extra adjustment step, you're hitting the ball at your front knee in your power zone. And if you're not taking that extra step, you are hitting the ball off balance, and you're not giving yourself at all your best opportunity to hit a good shot. So at a high level, that is extremely, extremely important. Another thing that I thought Charlie did a great job at, and this is going to be a theme in this episode, is his shot selection was, I thought, very intelligent. A lot of guys are going for too low of percentage shots. And Charlie, he really doesn't have a powerful game, but he keeps the ball. He hits such good angles, and his shot selection is dominated by passing shots. So he's going down the line or cross court passing shots and beating you to death with those shots, where even if you keep it alive, he then gives himself more of a setup. And even if you keep that next shot alive, he has another setup. And it's kind of this progressive chess match where he's hitting high percentage shots for himself that are getting weaker and weaker returns from his opponent, to the point where he finally has a setup and he's able to put it away, usually just with a lower and lower pass shot in a better position. So that passing shot selection, which I'm going to get into in the instructional, and we're getting it into in the interview with Jim Winterton, is really important. I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize that. And the final thing, as far as Charlie's play, that I think was a takeaway for me is how mentally focused he was. And of course, it's obvious to say that one should be mentally focused and in the zone, but it was very clear just looking at Charlie's face throughout the tournament, and he's usually not easily flustered, but in this particular tournament, you could just tell he was more in the zone than normal. He was literally just unfazed by any sort of, you know, if he hit a bad shot, if the referee made a bad call, anything like that, and it's not easy to do. So having that ability to be unfazed and totally mentally focused throughout a match, which Charlie had, I think is extremely valuable and something I'm going to be trying to implement into my game, which I already try to implement that into my game, but even more so than ever, I'm going to try to take that into account when I'm practicing and when I'm focusing on what I need to improve on. So those will probably be topics of discussion in future episodes, you know, conditioning, shot selection, mental focus in the mental game in general. But I wanted to get into that now, as those I think were important takeaways for me now that I'm going to be focusing on, and I think it will help you guys if you focus on it as well. So in this instructional segment of episode 4, I want to get into something that Jim Winterton discusses in our interview with him. And he discusses kind of the core of racquetball. He says you can break the essence of racquetball down basically into the phrase that dominating center court will win you games. You want to get your opponent out of center court and get yourself into center court. And I wanted to get a bit deeper into that. Jim talked about how that was said to him by kind of an elder statesman at his club. And he gave him the, hey, Sonny, hit the ball up the wall. That's how you win games. But didn't really tell him how to do that or maybe why you should be doing that. So I wanted to get a bit deeper into that in this instructional segment. And the argument I think is the best for how to get your opponent out of center court is hitting a more steady diet of pass shots as opposed to what would traditionally be considered kill shots, like a pinch or just trying to hit the ball an inch high, regardless of where it is on the wall. And I want to get into the why of why you should be hitting pass shots as your primary shot selection. So pass shots give you a very high margin for error, and that's really important because if you're going for shots that are, say, 1 inch high and you miss vertically, so if you miss vertically down, you're hitting a skip. If you miss vertically up and say you're going for a pinch or something that's not a good passing shot, then you're hitting something that is a setup for your opponent. You're leaving it out in the middle of the court for them to just wail on. Whereas if you hit a pass shot, your margin for error is much better, and that's because you can miss laterally or vertically a little bit, and you're still going to be hitting a generally good shot. It's not going to end the rally, maybe. It's not going to be a kill shot, but it'll make your opponent move, and that's kind of the name of the game. So passing shots, defined as either a down line or a cross court, those are going to be the shots that make your opponent move as much as possible, outside of, a kill shot that dies in front of your opponent. But that's not what we're talking about here because that's such a low percentage shot. And the reason, if you think of center court, if your opponent's in center court, the reason that makes them move the most is basically if you were to laterally draw a line to where your opponent has to move to get that ball, on a down-the-line pass shot to either the left or the right, that's a ball that's right up against the wall. And then similarly, on a cross-court shot, you should be hitting a wide-angle cross-court, which means that the ball is hitting directly across from where your opponent is standing. So in either scenario, your opponent has to go all the way across to the edge of the wall to get your ball, assuming that you hit it perfectly along that wall. But even if you don't, and it's a few feet off the wall, or maybe even, I don't know, 5 feet off the wall, then it's still a tough shot for your opponent to get to. They're still having to move, and when they're moving, they're not able to combat your shot effectively. They're not getting to it and having a setup.
So you're putting your opponent in a tough position and making them move a lot, which will tire them out and make their return shots much more difficult. So that's kind of the why of why you should be hitting these shots. You'll get your opponent out of center court and be able to dominate it yourself. Now let's get into the what is maybe more important, the how of how to get your opponent out of center court, how to hit pass shots. And I think you commonly see people messing up in this regard. So common ways that people mess up their pass shots are, especially for down the lines, slicing the ball is the first thing I see. And this is actually a really hard thing not to do. I think you look at a lot of players at the pro level and you see a fair amount of slicing. I know I do it myself and it's something I'm working on. So how to not slice the ball is you want to have a swing that where your direction of force as much as possible is, say you're going for a down the line, is as straight forward as you can make it. You want the ball to be coming off the front wall as straight as it came in and not coming in with spin and then coming out with spin, which will slow it down and force it to move laterally. So slicing the ball will mess up your down the line pass shot significantly. A way that people mess up cross-court shots are that they aren't hitting wide-angle cross-court shots. And this seems obvious, but you see it very, very often. People are hitting cross-courts that are intended to hit the very back corner on the opposite side that they're standing, as opposed to hitting a cross-court shot that should be hitting directly across from where their opponent is standing on the side wall. So that's not going to force your opponent to move as much. And if you think about the trajectory of a ball that's going to hit the corner, it almost passes through center court. So to get your opponent to move, if your opponent's able to attack that ball before it gets to the back wall, they're not having to move nearly as much as they would had you hit a wide-angle cross court that's hitting the side wall directly across from where your opponent is. Another common mistake is hitting the ball too high, and this is something that we addressed in episode 1 in the instructional segment there. You should be hitting the ball basically at your front knee at about that height or lower. You see a lot of players hitting the ball chest high, shoulder high, and that forces the trajectory of your shot to be either coming in from high and coming low, which pops the ball up, or just remaining high the whole time, which is not a good case in any way. And one note on down-the-line shots is, so wide-angle cross-court shots should be hitting the sidewall. Down-the-line shots, as much as possible, you want to be making those one-wall shots. In other words, they just hit the front wall, and then until they bounce twice, they don't hit any other walls. They just hit that front wall, and that's going to make it so that your opponent, it doesn't slow the ball down in any way, and they're not able to play the ball off the back wall. So aiming for that, that's like the gold standard of racquetball shots, basically, the one wall down the line shot. You should essentially be, as far as your shot selection, until your opponent is reading this, your primary option should be going for a down the line one wall pass shot. Then secondarily, you should be going for a cross court pass, wide angle cross court. And then probably a third option after that, say they're taking away those two things and playing back. When they're playing back, that's when you can go for those kill shots, those pinches, aiming a little bit low, but you'll have more margin for error when your opponent is then back. So if you were to watch a very dominant racquetball game, you're likely to, if you pay attention to the positioning, you're likely to see the dominating player dominating center court. You're likely to see that person moving their opponent around and their opponent barely getting to balls and hitting a setup. And then when you have that setup, you go for a passing shot and then your opponent barely gets it. You have a better setup and you have progressively better and better setups until you have such an easy shot that you can put it away easily or until your opponent makes a mistake. So pay attention to really dominant games. That's what you're likely to see. Just dominant center court positioning. And I think that's reflected by Winterton's advice. So this is, of course, a high-level summary. There are many more intricacies to this skill, the dominating center court skill. And Winterton could get much more into that. I could get much more into that. But I think for now, that's a good high-level summary of how to dominate center court for yourself so that you can be more effective in matches. Good luck out there. All right, so here we have, I'm with Jim Winterton and Thomas Carter. Jim Winterton is a famous coach. He's coach of Kame Wasilenchuk, Ronda Rasic. Thomas is a professional player who's kind of broken into the pro tour lately. Thomas and Jim, how are you today?
Pretty good, thanks. I also helped Dylan Reed once upon a time.
Absolutely, yeah. I did a video lesson with Jim.
Cup of coffee.
Super helpful.
And then you fired me.
I wouldn't say that. So, Jim, as a longtime coach, as far as tips for what you'd have for an intermediate or beginner player, what would be the first thing that you would tell them that could most influence their game?
Okay, so basically, if you try to keep the game as simple as you possibly can, it's a game of keeping the ball out of center court so that you can be in center court. I mean, that's at the simplest level, that's what you're trying to do. And that holds true whether you're playing at your guys' level, professional, or whether you're playing a beginner. You want to keep the ball out of center court. And when I teach a beginning lesson, the first thing I want to do is get people hitting the ball, having fun, and hitting them like little puff balls that they can get to. In some cases, even that doesn't work. I have to just have them serve, just stand there and serve the ball until they can serve it and move. You know, if you ever taught a beginner, they'll serve the ball and they're all excited, and then the ball comes back to them and they realize they had to move to get to the next shot. So, yeah. But that type of thing, at its simplest level, that's what the game's about. And as you go up the ranks, it continues to be that. Only it's a lot harder to keep the ball out of center court as yeah. you move up the ranks.
Yeah, and you find that there are kind of intricacies as to how to get that opponent out of center court and how to maintain center court yourself.
That's correct, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thomas, what is, as far as things you see when you see a beginner or intermediate player or even an advanced player, what do you see that they could be doing that could improve their game?
Yeah, so going off of that, what Coach was saying, I mean, obviously the goal is to get the ball out of center court, but sort of what Coach looks at and how he sort of had me train me to view it is it comes down to the footwork and the mechanics. Yeah. How, once you get to the ball, how do you actually keep the ball out of center court by the way you hit it and by the way you move to the ball, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think there, from my point of view, there's a lot of coaches – a lot of people work on what shot to hit. And I remember when I first started playing, an old guy, probably my age, and I was probably your age, and I'm on the court, and this old guy knocks on the door and says, "Sonny, keep the ball down the line. That's all you got to do. You want to win in this game, hit it up and down the walls."
Yeah.
So I said, "But how do you do that?" "No, I don't know. Just hit it up and down the wall. That's what I do. I just hit it." "Well, how do you do it?" I don't know. And so I got that a lot when I first started. Well, how do you do that? And, you know, I had to find out. And back when I started, nobody was talking. The sport was brand new, and anybody that knew anything wasn't sharing because they wanted to win the tournaments. Mm-hmm. And there was information and even misinformation. People were – I remember I had a doubles partner who was a really good athlete, and he went for a lesson, and this star player told him to run around his backhand, hit forehands, don't worry about your backhand. So, of course, every time he played that guy, his backhand got picked on because he took poor advice. So.
Yeah. Yeah, you find that there's sometimes kind of band-aid advice or short-term advice where that might help somebody short-term who has a poor backhand, but long-term, you got to learn how to develop a backhand.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It's and as you know, I see the what to hit, how to hit it. This is a brand new sport, and we were talking a few minutes ago before the broadcast about your experience in baseball, and baseball is full of these wise coaches that know little things like release point for pitchers and weight shift for hitters and keeping your hands back and all these things, because baseball's centuries old and racquetball's not. Racquetball's a brand new sport, and most people are teaching racquetball the way they played instead of keeping up with the latest sports science and technology. And if you look at, I like to look at the money sports, football, baseball, tennis, you know, they win a pro stop in tennis, they're getting a Mercedes and $1 million check.
Yeah.
You know, not a couple $100 in a t-shirt like they do for racquetball. So the knowledge is a very high level. I don't know if you knew this or not, but there, I don't know if it's still on the internet, but Roger Federer had one of his practices broadcast over Christmas last year. And it was a fascinating watch. It really was. Now, they didn't get into how to do everything, because that's top secret, I'm sure. But just what he did for the full hour of practice was amazing.
Yeah. What particular things do you find interesting about what Roger did?
Well, first of all, how he warmed up. His coach started feeding him a tennis ball. He tossed it to him with his right hand. He had to catch it with his left hand, throw it back with the right hand, and so on and so forth. So they're working on nerve paths, I'm imagining, on both sides of the body, left brain, right brain.
Yeah, interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't see anybody in racquetball doing that, frankly.
Well, here's a little top secret stuff. When we give out homework, we don't just say hit drive serves right and drive serves left or serves right and serves left, because when you're in a match, you have to change from either side. So if you're practicing, you should be practicing both sides, because that's what you have to do in a match so that you're not predictable.
Yeah, smart. So you are famously Kane Wozlenczyk's coach, the number one player currently and of all time, I would argue, and most would argue. What has that experience been like, coaching Kane?
I wish Kane was here, because he and I have talked about this. I kind of feel the same way, and I don't like to speak for Kane, but I'm pretty sure I'm on the right path with this. He was number one when he hired me, and yeah. I was shocked that he wanted to hire me. And I like to think I was a pretty decent coach when he hired me. I had my world champions, and I had my national champions. And I do a tip of the day on my Facebook page. And I've got a tip of the day from 1981 that's coming. And my brother sent me a news clipping from the Poughkeepsie Journal when I lived down there in 1981. And I'm giving a tip on the forehand and backhand. And that tip is still relevant today. But also in my bio on that tip, I'd already had 6 national champions by 1981. So I was coaching before I met Kane, and I like to think that I'm not a great coach because of Kane Wozlenczyk.
Sure.
And Kane's not a great player because of Jim Winterton.
Yep.
But the fact that I didn't need him, or he didn't need me, basically I think helped us a lot. Because we both have to give credit to each other. Obviously, he's learned something from me, but I hope. But I've learned a ton from watching him.
Yeah.
And Tom Berenger, the actor, you know, he goes to the U.S. Open, and I was talking with him, and he asked me this question about coaching Kane, and I said it's kind of like a director of a movie with Sir Laurence Olivier or some great actor. You pretty much have to let that actor, you know, freelance and do what they can do, and try not to restrict them too much. And that's kind of the way I was when I first started with him. I worried I didn't want to make him a racquetball robot. He did so many things intuitively. And someone has great intuition. You don't want to mess that up.
Yeah. I remember my dad always talks about this. He was, I wouldn't say my coach or anything, but he would give my brother and I advice when we were young and growing up, just older, more experienced.
Can I do a sidebar before you go any further?
Yeah.
Your father I have the utmost respect for him. Sure. And long before I ever met you, I remember watching him as a junior dad, and I always thought, this guy has the best attitude of anybody I ever saw. He wanted you guys to win. I know that.
Yeah.
But he also stayed out of your way. He allowed you to lose. He understood it. He understood that you don't win every time. And often you learn more by losing than you do winning. That's very tough, and not every parent can do that. I'm sorry to get off
track. No, I
wanted to give your dad a plug, because and Thomas's father is the same way. He's always understood that, and I never forgot that dirty look, like my kid's losing because of you. And I have gotten that look from other parents, no doubt about it.
Yeah, that's almost exactly what I was going to say. My dad remembers at one point we took a timeout and he just didn't say anything to us, maybe handed us a water or something and let us go back in the court. And you said to him, like, you know, one of the greatest things you can do as a coach or a mentor is just not give any advice, just let the player do his thing. Sometimes that's what they need. So, yeah, that's what he always brings up when he talks about you.
Well, okay, so I'm at Arizona State. I'm sorry to get off track, but
go for it.
Thomas will tell you I spin off on these stories. A kid comes up to me. I'm teaching racquetball. He says, I don't know who to play. I got here late. And I said, well, just knock on the door. He said, well, I don't know these people. I'll knock on the door and ask. I said, did you grow up in a community where you played organized sports? And, like, you always had a coach and you always had a team. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I grew up without that. And we had to make our own games. And we played baseball. And I remember the little kids, you would throw them grounders so they could hit the ball. The big kids could only hit the right field if they were left-handed, or to left field if they were right-handed. Yeah. And you had all these nobody told us. We made these rules up so we could have a game. And we called each other and organized our own games. Yeah. And that skill gets lost in all our organized sports today. And I think that the creativity gets lost. And when the old-timers I talk to in racquetball, they watch you guys play, that's the first thing they say. Where's the creativity? Where's the messed up shot? Where's the thing that nobody expects? You know where everybody's going with the ball all the time. You seem to. And that's the feedback I get. Where's the creativity? And so I take that to heart. I keep trying to move ahead of the game instead of have the game move ahead of me.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I was just reading something about how some of the most innovative people of all time didn't have formal schooling necessarily, or did things outside of formal schooling that allowed them to get creative and innovative in ways that the standard structured way doesn't teach you. So
that's right.
Yeah, that's great.
Racquetball's no different. You mentioned Kane. I mean, he practices, but he practices, I think, differently than anybody in racquetball because he's always stretching the limits. What can I do here? What can I do there? How do I hit the ball here? How do I hit the ball there?
Yeah.
And he's shown me a couple of things that are just mind-blowing to me. But it's a result of spending so much time on the court and in a creative way. Not like, oh, I got to hit 10 forehands, 10 backhands. No, it's not like that. Yeah. It's like, well, let's see if I drop the ball here. Let's see if I do this. Let's see if I do that. That's how you really get good. There's a book titled Be So Good They Can't Ignore You. That's one of my favorite books.
Yeah, Cal Newport.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I read that. I mean, it's mostly career advice, but that's funny relating it back to
racquetball. Well, but it's the same whether really anything. And he uses a lot of examples from music and in industry and everything, but sports is the same way. The greatest of the greats basically taught themselves to a certain degree.
Sure. Yeah. So being Kane's coach, what would you say you have learned from him?
Oh, wow. Where do I begin with that? All right, so I've been watching him 12 years. And if I stand behind the court, I can't tell you what serve he's going to hit. I can't tell you what shot he's going to hit. I've tried, and it's a guessing game. I don't know. And if I don't know and I've watched him 12 years, the poor guy in the court has no idea. It's also very difficult for me to see some of my students play him and get annihilated and look at the score and think, I'm not that good. It's not that. It's that he is really good. It's not that you're not good. And I see players improving. Over the years, he and I, after a match, have gone back to the room and said, geez, that guy's improved. And, you know, and it's true, they have. But so has he.
Yeah, awesome. What do you think has allowed Kane to gain such a level of dominance? I mean, recently it seems like nobody's even close to him.
It's not quantity of practice. It's quality of practice and experimenting. It's also God-given ability. But I can think of like seven guys on the tour with the same kind of ability. It's not ability. He just didn't wake up one day and start playing like this. Yeah. If you go back to the old video of him from the early days, he wasn't the same guy. And, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, but I actually coached against him. When I coached the United States and when I coached in Mexico, I coached for Mexico. And in Mexico, I coached Alvaro Beltran the year 2000, and Alvaro won the Worlds. He beat Rocky, and he beat Kane in that tournament. So there's a long way from, and he's improved every year. I have to say every year he's improved. Yeah. He was suspended 2 years, and in that 2 years, he came back, and it was unbelievable. And he talked to me once in 2 years. That was it.
Wow.
Well, he was pretty upset by what happened,
yeah.
But as you could imagine. But he used that time to get better and better and better.
Yeah.
Beyond, he took everything that I told him, and he went to a place I never knew existed with it. That's what happened, basically.
Yeah, he's incredible. So Kane's practice schedule, I mean, is it completely unscheduled, or do you?
All right, this is a good question.
Yeah.
12 years ago, when we started working together, he said, I'll do my cane bone. Winterton, let me tell you what I do. And I said, stop right there. I coach for a living. Don't tell me what you do. I got a big mouth, and yeah. I can't keep a secret. When you give me a coaching piece of advice that works, I will take it and run with it. And so when you retire, fill me in. But let's keep it your time.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the way we've done it. I've been to a couple of his workouts, but you wouldn't even think they were workouts. It's kind of like sponsored doubles. He's playing, he's hitting the ball around, he's laughing. He's hitting it behind his back, and it appears like he's doing nothing, but that's not really what's happening. It's an illusion. He's looking to see what trick shots he can hit, what he can hit, how he can hit it, and that's what's going on. So he's always in a creative mode when he plays.
Yeah.
The best way I can describe it.
Yeah, certainly. And you can see it in this game. He has some of the most creative and innovative shots.
Yep.
So, Thomas, having worked with Jim, I'm sure learned a lot from him. What would you say are the most major things you've learned?
Well, definitely. So I started working with Coach a little over 5 years ago, actually, when I was about 16 years old. And looking back, it's amazing to realize what I didn't know at that point.
Yeah.
Coach did a camp in Pittsburgh, and that's where I met him. And right away, we got working on the same stuff he gets working on with all of his athletes. Starts out with forehand and backhand, and goes to footwork from there. And just over the years, just putting in the work, you know, getting better isn't just a straight line up when you're working on the footwork and mechanics. I mean,
yeah.
you take dips and there are bumps in the road, and but you just got to keep kind of grinding, and that's sort of how it's been. I mean, it's been a long road, and it's still going, and I just try it. And every time we get a chance to work together, either on the court or through video, there's just always something new to keep on working at.
Yeah.
You're kind of glossing over. Let's talk about the heartbreaking defeats that you had.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I was losing a lot, and There were times when it didn't seem like I was ever going to win, but...
I mean, he's working with me. His parents are paying me, and he's losing. And he's getting ahead, and he looks like... the first junior tournament we went to, he was beating the guy, and then all of a sudden, it went away. And it happened not just once. It happened over and over, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And he would just keep plugging along, and... I mean, came out to see me and visited me in Arizona several times, and we'd train out there. And I got videos of him doing footwork drills on the side of the pool when it's 100 degrees outside and stuff like that. But he just kept plugging away. And then last year, I consider last year the breakthrough year.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah, yeah, I mean... Losing sucks, but it's really just sort of about that process, you know? You got to just keep plugging away.
How are you able to deal with continually losing and sticking with it? Was that a motivating factor for you?
Yeah, I mean, I always thought I should have been winning, you know? Yeah. when I look at these players, there are a lot of people I look at and I think, why can't I beat them? You know, why are they better than me right now? So just that motivation to keep getting better.
Yeah, and you were a guy I've noticed, I mean, you didn't have super high pedigree in junior racquetball.
Definitely not.
Where a lot of the top players nowadays did, were top four guys or whatever growing up in junior racquetball. But now you've gone on to be very successful. I mean, you just won collegiate nationals. You've had good results on the professional tour. What do you think allowed you to, like, quickly build those skills and get to the level you're at now?
Well, again, first of all, it wasn't quickly.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That's one thing right there. I guess it would just keeps going back to the process. I mean, Cliff Swain's a great example. Did he even ever win a junior title? Maybe he won one. Do you?
I remember him getting beat as a junior. Big upset. Yeah.
Wow, I assumed he was good.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure he was good, but I assumed he was top junior.
But, yeah, and he's one of the best players of all time. I mean, you got lots of people who come up as top juniors and continue to take that path, and there are other players who don't really. Because, I mean, long term, it's not about winning right away. It's about being the best player you can be and winning in the long run, you know? I mean... Again, going back to Kane, I mean, look how dominant he's been for the past however long. You know, again, like Coach was saying, I mean, when he started out, it's not like he's the player he was today. He's just every year he's getting better, and that's so impressive to me to watch that.
Yeah. So do you guys think, I mean, he has been getting better and better every year, it seems like. Do you think, I mean, he's aging. Do you think that trend will continue?
Who?
Kane, sorry.
Oh.
Kane has been getting better every year.
Well, sooner or later, father time gets everybody.
Yeah.
Or is it mother time? I don't know. But time gets...
One of those time parents.
time gets everybody sooner or later. And, I don't know. He always told me that he wanted to play until he was 40, and I did the math, and I was thinking I'd better get a walker or something if I'm going to still be coaching. but, you know... There's no measure, and to look at Tom Brady and people like that, athletes like that, there's no rule book on that. But sooner or later, it gets you. Trust me, sooner or later.
Yeah.
And you know, we've talked about that. We've I was very involved coming up. I might be more involved going down. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's in basketball, they say that the great athletes like Michael Jordan and people like that played above the rim, and then they had to learn to play below the rim.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of the way racquetball is, the same way.
Huh. Yeah. Do you think he'll be interested in kind of quitting while he's on top, or will it be?
I cannot speak for him.
Idea.
I have. I have no idea.
Sure.
My gut feeling is he would want to go out on top like any athlete would.
Yeah.
But I've seen a lot of athletes stay with it too long, and I respect them for that the same way as I respect someone that doesn't. It's their career. It's their choice.
Yeah. So I'd like to transition a little bit to just the sport in general and where you see it at. I think it's clear to just about anyone that the sport has declined over the years in terms of participation and popularity. I'd imagine you guys would agree with that. What do you think would be something that could help turn it around or help increase participation and interest?
Well, figure skating got big when Tanya Harding's bodyguard took a pipe to her. I hope we don't do that. A little history. Racquetball, I was a pro in a racquetball club, and I was a very important person. I was hired to program and teach racquetball, put people on the court. That's because membership was $100 and some a year, and court time was $15 an hour. So you had to bring in money by programming. The minute monthly dues came around, you didn't need a racquetball pro anymore. Racquetball pro was not important. A salesperson that sold memberships, that would be important. And then they figured out how to do personal training. So it's economic. So as a result, and, you know, I guess everybody's guilty. You can't just point the finger. But to me, USA Racquetball and all the racquetball organizations missed out when they stopped being the friend of club owners and became the enemy, basically, by programming tournaments that hurt members. Members complain, you know, I can't get in my parking space. I go for my workout, and there's a racquetball person there. And yet they don't complain about 500 people running a 5K on a Sunday morning. They understand that. So it's a marketing thing, and the way we've marketed our sport is the famous line in the fitness industry is, I got my choice, free racquetball or towel service. They're both about the same to me. And that's what people say. And so they don't understand the value of the racquetball player who stays at the club forever, doesn't leave. You don't have to worry about renewal, the social aspect of it.
Yeah.
And the other things, and I must be an optimist, but I don't see racquetball dying ever. Sure. I really don't. I see it going back to the Ys and to the colleges, maybe where it started. I see it more public recreation, if they would do it. But there's this attitude. Well, it's dying in Podunk, so it must be dying here. Arizona State just took out three courts for no reason. Well, other than they went to a conference somewhere, and that seemed to be the trend that's going down, so let's take the courts out. So they got three courts sitting there doing nothing. Meanwhile, kids trying to get on a court to play, and they can't play. So I don't mean to pick on Arizona State. They're not the only
one.
When I came to Syracuse, New York, I lived there. We were 84 courts in 1984, and when I left in 2008, there were three courts left in public courts.
Yeah.
So I think that if we can get somebody like they did for bowling, someone that brought bowling back and marketed it, the same could happen in racquetball. In fact, when racquetball was booming, it was often compared to bowling. When racquetball started booming, they compared it to bowling because bowling, the sport of bowling boomed. Everybody was in a bowling league after World War II in the 50s and 60s. Huh. And so when racquetball exploded in the 70s, I hated it. I used to cringe when I heard that. Well, it's just like bowling. But now I kind of understand what they mean. It exploded and then it's gone, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't love the comparison either, you know, bowling. I'd like to think we're a little more athletic and
mobile. A lot more athletic, yeah. but it kind of, I mean, it did explode. I mean, the athletes were on primetime television. They were on Wide World of Sports. They were celebrities. If you went on a plane or something, everybody knew who the pros were back in the day. And to this day, wherever you go, most people know the name Marty Hogan. because of his exposure through a place a few miles from here that sells sneakers.
Yeah, I think I know which place you're talking about. Good old Nike. I think racquetball, from a marketing perspective, it's such a enjoyable sport. You can, you know, it's one of the best sports for fitness. Social-wise, it's great, especially if you have an atmosphere where at some clubs, you know, you'll be around some of your best friends and you play socially and then interact after.
If there's anybody out there ever thinking of building a club, the LA Fitness model, and they do some things wrong, that's for sure, but the LA Fitness model of facing the exercise equipment toward the racquetball courts so you can watch racquetball is the way to market racquetball because the average player, you look at the average player playing racquetball and you go, oh, I can do that.
Yeah.
But if you watch you two guys play, you're going to go, oh, I don't know if I can do that, you know, because of the high level. No.
Yeah, and yeah, it's thinking of fitness machines and everything, I mean, those get a ton of participation. People hop on fitness machines, no question, but when it comes to playing a fun sport that would get you into shape, I don't understand why that isn't a bigger
thing. Well, there again, there's lies and what's the damn lies and statistics.
Sure.
Okay, so I remember last year they were running around with a clipboard seeing who was on the courts at Arizona State, and there was nobody on the court. There were no people on the courts from like 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and they're jotting this down, but there's only three people on the fitness machines that I counted out of about 100 machines, but they're not writing that down. That's taken for granted. And in the aerobics rooms are empty because there aren't any classes at that time.
Yeah.
The classes are prime time. People are looking at it with a fitness brain, not a participation brain. They don't understand. In racquetball, it seems like the decision is being made by a non-racquetball person that doesn't understand racquetball, that is just sees, you know, we rip that down, I can, you know, put a climbing wall in there.
Get all the square footage back.
Or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate. Thomas, do you see any ways that you think of that would help grow the sport?
Yeah, well, sort of going off that, what I think some of these fitness places don't understand is the community that racquetball builds. So when someone is a racquetball member at a club, they're a member for life because, sort of like you were saying, all their friends play there.
Yeah.
They don't want to go anywhere else because that's their group of people. Where if I'm lifting weights and a gym opens up 2 miles closer to my house, why wouldn't I join there, you know? So, it has its place, and I think it definitely has a role in a gym that some of these fitness people won't exactly understand. The other thing is it's a fun sport. I think we can all agree on that. I mean, just introducing it to people, I don't know anyone I've introduced it to that hasn't loved it, you know?
And
if you can tell someone they can go run on a treadmill for a half hour or go play two games of racquetball, to me, that's a no-brainer.
That's probably one of the things you mentioned, fitness people. Racquetball people are fitness people.
Yeah.
And that's what's misunderstood. I know I work for, you know, a company, I don't want to mention its name, but I couldn't believe that you can't cross market. To me, it was a no-brainer. If I'm a personal trainer, I would send my customers to play some racquetball. I'd send my racquetball players to up to train with the trainers.
Yeah.
But you know that it doesn't work that way. They're separate threads of income. You don't get any credit financially. So you know, the way it's set up even is you're set up almost you're almost doomed the way that it's set up. I mean, I've been manager and in a lot of management meetings, and finally the solution was not to invite me to any more meetings because I would always say, well, wait a minute, what about racquetball? Why are you making this decision?
I found one of the things, I was talking to Rocky a little bit, and he said he's a club pro at a big club, and he said, because I do think financial is kind of the way you have to look at things in terms of how you grow the sport and why it might be decreasing. And he was saying when he was able to show the club that he was able to bring in membership and what those membership dollars meant to them, especially over the lifetime of a membership, That was huge, and they like totally understood the value of it. But I think sometimes that's missed out on when people are thinking about a club and, oh, we can get this much square footage back by getting rid of a racquetball court.
Yeah, so. I mean, where I used to work, they would sign up for racquetball, and I would say, well, where does that revenue stream go? Well, it goes under fitness to the fitness. Is what about racquetball? Well, you get that from running leagues and lessons. Well, these people join because of racquetball.
Yeah.
And no, it's going to go under fitness. And so he's the fitness director / club manager. Of course it's going to go under fitness.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that's exasperating when you're in racquetball.
Yeah, sad. What changes do you have planned as far as have you always coached the same way? And how do you plan to, I guess, change in the future is in terms of what you're doing? Are there any plans?
I'm going to deflect that to Thomas. Have I always coached the same way?
Not at all. I think just from being coached up by coach to watching him teach other players, I always learn something new about the way he's teaching. It's not, he's always on the cutting edge. I feel learning and growing with the sport from outside sports, kind of as we were talking earlier, like the big money sports. Because going back to the whole point that racquetball is such a brand new sport, you got to adapt. And I think that's what coach is so great at. There's always something he's learning. He's always at the
My
forefront.
Wife is always, not always, but she's would like me not to travel as much. And
yeah.
I've cut back on my travel. But I have to travel to keep learning. Every tournament, I learn something. I see the game as it's changing before it changes. And even back in the 80s, the round of 16s and the quarters, I always wanted to watch the round of 16s and the quarters to see what players were coming up, what players were going to be good, what players were going down, who's coming up, and to see how the game's changing. And when you stop traveling, and so for a number of years I couldn't travel. My son was young, and I didn't have the resources, so I did one major camp and one tournament a year. And I always had some kind of a tune-up every year so I could learn something. In those days, selfishly for my game, but these days just to learn something so I can keep coaching.
Yeah,
and learning.
Very cool. What advice would you give to someone who's trying to do coaching and coaches, say, juniors or intermediate or beginner players? What advice would you give to a person like that?
All right, so the first thing, and this is not written in stone, but I have seen, I always felt that if you as a player put it all out there, everything, left it out there, you did your best and played your best, you have the background to be a good coach. If you didn't, if you cut corners, if you tried to somehow dial it in, I always felt like that person wouldn't be a good racquetball coach, no matter what. Now, that's probably wrong, because I'm sure there are exceptions, but I think as a player, as an old 71-year-old guy, I did it. I put myself through about every kind of training program there is. And the kids that I ask them to do stuff, I did twice as much or three times as much.
Yeah.
And so I know what it's like to do all that work and get screwed on a call at 10-10 and a tiebreaker. I know what that's like.
Yeah.
I know what it's like to get a bad draw because somebody has it in for you politically, or a racket company has it in for you,
yeah,
or something. This is all stuff that goes with the territory. And as professional players, you learn to deal with all this stuff and suck it up and do your best. And as when it comes to coaching, you have to be able to empathize with your athletes. And to me, the best coaching isn't done and in the victory stand. The best coaching is done the years or days or months or however long you work with that athlete before they get there. So it's often as Thomas said, it's not a straight line up. It's
advance,
decline, advance, decline, advance, decline. It's a bumpy road to the top. And then, you know, watching Kane at the top, that's another thing. Getting to the top is one thing. Staying at the top is another thing. You stop being the hunter and you become the hunted. So.
Yeah, one thing, I think we've talked about this before, but Kane, I think a lot of people view in his mind, Kane would look at his competition and say, I'm way better than them. I don't have to hardly try to beat these guys. Would you say that's the case?
Again, I feel uncomfortable talking for Kane.
Okay.
I believe that, okay, so there's an old saying in pro racquetball, you have to have a short memory. You get beat, you have to forget it and come back. Well, he has a short memory when he wins. He takes everybody very seriously. He doesn't take anyone for granted. He goes out there to win. And he might, you know, he'd be playing his best friend. He will still try to donut you. He's not, that's just the way, I don't know, the way he's made. I never seen anybody like him before.
Yeah.
Sometimes he'll stay on the court a little longer for a workout, you know, maybe. But most of the time he's putting the hammer down. And that's just the way he's made. Like I said, he's focused. I feel uncomfortable speaking for him because he does a good job of explaining it. I've heard him in other interviews say one of the things about learning his craft. And I go back to that book, Be So Good You Can't Ignore You.
Yeah.
He's not trying to make money and not trying to do the victory thing as much as he's trying to improve. And if you keep focusing on improving, you're going to continue to improve and continue to be working on different things, like hopefully I'm doing in coaching and you guys are doing playing.
Yeah. I'm always amazed by the fact that Kane never seems to let up at all. It's always cutthroat. I'm going to rip your heart out to every single opponent. And I've found it so easy to at times lose focus or slip up or cut back on the effort a little bit. You never see that in this game.
No, not much at all.
It's amazing. Yeah, very impressive. All right. Well, thank you guys for coming on. Jim, is there anything you'd like to plug? I know you do coaching and everything. Is there anything
all right.
like that?
So there was I do a tip of the day on WintertonRacquetball.com, and I collect them out there. So on my website, there are about 20 tips of the day. And the best tip of the day I ever did was my elevator pitch, right?
Okay.
My elevator pitch clip went something like this. I read about an elevator pitch, and you know what? You guys know what an elevator pitch is.
Sure.
Right. So you're writing up two floors, and you got two floors to pitch your business or your what you do, in my case, coaching. And I don't have an elevator pitch.
Okay.
I have and a couple of apps, Winterton Racquetball for Life. I have another app on iOS that's out of that has to be updated, by the way, and we're working on that, working through that. And I do monthly coaching, but I don't have an elevator pitch because an elevator pitch would mean I'd be trying to talk you into something.
Yeah.
And I don't try to talk anybody into anything. And that, my friends, is my elevator pitch.
Wow. I don't have an elevator pitch.
I actually wrote that. I actually wrote that. I always thought that was probably one of the best ones I ever did.
Yeah, that's great. Wow. Creative. Thomas, is there anything you'd like to plug?
At this point, not right now. I mean, I'm as a player, I'm obviously trying to find ways to make money in racquetball. So
yeah.
Coach is sort of taking me under his wing as helping me build up my coaching too, so I'm also available for monthly coaching if anyone out there is interested in learning more.
Awesome.
You can feel free to message me on Facebook or email me at thomas_f_carter@yahoo.com.
Great. Yeah, and I've
Thomas has a couple of students now and is doing some clinics and does some lessons for me, so some of my customers or some of the people I work with, I can't get out to the tournaments and he happens to be there, so it's working out pretty well.
Awesome. Yeah, well, thanks so much for coming on, guys. And I can say I've had experience of talking to both of you, and you would be great resources for anyone who's interested.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for All having right. us.
Thanks, everybody. right, so getting into the mailbag section of episode 4, we have two questions this time. The first question, dear Racquet Bros, to achieve prime racquetball conditioning, there is obviously some training recommended, but I've heard a lot of different workout regimens to get diesel for the game. What would you personally recommend? How much drilling, running, playing, lifting? So this is obviously going to be dependent, signed Swole in STL. So love it, first of all. I always appreciate the desire to get diesel. This is going to be dependent person to person, of course. It depends on your skill set, but I think oftentimes people focus on the skill aspect of the game and ignore the conditioning element of the game. So I think it's a great thing to focus on. Now, in terms of what you should be doing for your conditioning, running, lifting, playing, drilling, etc., I think the best thing for you is whatever you enjoy and will do frequently. So really, practice and repetition is going to be the best thing for your game. Obviously, you know, perfect practice makes perfect. Don't just go out there and do reps, but do them with a purpose. But I think that whatever you're going to be most energized by and most excited to do regularly so that you'll do it often, that's the best thing for you. If you hate running, maybe try it out and maybe try to get yourself more into it. But if you hate running, don't run. If you hate lifting, maybe don't lift. Do what you enjoy doing and will do regularly and often. So what I would recommend for peak performance, if you are willing to do whatever it takes, I would probably say that from a conditioning standpoint, you should be doing a lot of work on your legs, not a whole lot on your arms, and it should be a lot of footwork stuff and a lot of stuff that just beats up your legs, because I think that tends to be the first thing to go, in the sense that you may be, if your legs are getting tired before you're getting cardio tired, you should be working on training your legs rather than training your cardio. Now, if you get cardio tired before you're sore at all, then you should be kind of bumping up your heart rate more often. And another thing I have to say on the subject is that a long, slow cardio doesn't correlate well to racquetball. Racquetball is it's short bursts of high intensity energy, followed by a rest back into a short burst of high intensity energy expenditure. So you should be doing things that mimic that in order to improve your racquetball game, rather than long, slow cardio. But again, do whatever you enjoy doing that you're likely to do often. So if you don't want to do high intensity short bursts of workouts, do something that's long, slow cardio. Anything will help, but I'm just trying to give what would be the most optimal. Now, the second question comes from Brendan in St. Louis. So we have a St. Louis theme going on. Shout out to the St. Louis guys. Which is where I went to school, which may or may not be why we're getting questions from there. Hopefully we get questions from people all over, but from Brendan in St. Louis right now, he asks, can playing outdoor help your indoor game? And I would extend this to and vice versa. Yes. Again, to go off what I was saying in the previous question, I think any reps will be helpful. I even think, you know, cross-training to different sports can help your racquetball game. So any reps at anything athletic is going to be helpful. That being said, I think specifically focusing and targeting the sport you're playing and trying to make your workouts mimic exactly what you're going to be doing in the game, that's going to be the most effective for you. So if you want to focus on indoor to get better, you should just be playing a lot of indoor and doing workouts that mimic the skills in indoor. And then to get good at outdoor, you should play a lot of outdoor. They can help each other, I think, in the sense that more reps at anything is going to be a good thing ultimately, but you want to get reps that mimic what you're going to be doing in the games that matter most to you. So, for example, I like outdoor, but I care a lot more about indoor. I'm better at it. I try to focus on the indoor game. If you're more of an outdoor person, do the opposite. Focus on the outdoor game. I'll also say that one thing that can be valuable from that you can take from the outdoor game and learn in your indoor game that I think a lot of people miss in the indoor game is your ability to hit volleys, so take a ball out of the air, and your ability to cut the ball off, which I think people miss in the indoor game a fair amount. It will also actually teach you pass shots, which, you know, I talked about in the instructional segment. People don't hit a lot of those, as many as they should be, in my opinion, in the indoor game. And the outdoor game is great at teaching you that. You know, your goal is to get the ball past your opponent, and it's hard to kill it in front. So the outdoor game, I think, teaches those skills very well. So thank you for the questions, Swollen STL and Brendan. I appreciate it. In the future, guys, if you want to ask mailbag questions for us to answer on the show, you can email me at Dylan, D-Y-L-A-N, at racquetballshow.com, and we'll get to them on the show.
So that does it for episode 4 of the Racquetball Show podcast. For next episode, we have two athletes from the 209 area code, if you know where that is and what it means for racquetball. If you have any feedback or comments or questions that you'd want answered on the mailbag segment or anything you'd like to reach out to us about, I'd love to hear it. You can reach me at Dylan, D-Y-L-A-N, at racquetballshow.com. And I'd appreciate hearing anything from you guys. Thanks for listening.